Good morning. I'm your host, Claudia Shambaugh, welcoming you to the December 27th, 2022 edition of Ask Leader. You bet I'm live with you all. Today, as we close out this year together, a treat from two performing arts artistic directors. First, the retiring artistic director of American Ballet Theater, Kevin McKenzie, offers the long view of his 30 years leading that internationally acclaimed dance company. I thought it would be a bonus about 2 weeks ago, but we didn't have any time. Huntington's disease carried the whole show for obvious reasons. So here today, we're going to send you the whole interview I did. It was such a treat. In the second segment, we're going to have South Coast Repertory Theater Artistic Director David Ivers reflecting on coming back to full throttle this season. And he's going to offer early next year's Voices of America. It's two plays in conversations with each other, the classic Little Foxes and a new one, Appropriate. He's going to talk about that. We'll be right back after a station break. Don't go away, fans. Welcome back to the show. My guest in this segment is Kevin McKenzie, Artistic Director of the American Ballet Theater. As he is widely known around the world and has garnered many prizes and awards from his tremendous body of work as a performer, a choreographer, and an artistic director, I will offer a spare introduction in the interest of asking some particular matters about his leadership, shifts in the culture of ballet, where the art form is heading, along with reminding folks of the performances staged at the Segerstrom Performing Arts Center in nearby Costa Mesa. To introduce him then briefly, Kevin McKenzie was a leading dancer with both the Joffrey Ballet and the National Ballet of Washington before joining American Ballet Theatre as a soloist in March of 1979. He was appointed a principal dancer the following December and danced with the company until 1991. In September of 1989, he was appointed a permanent guest artist with the Washington Ballet and in 1991 assumed the position of artistic associate. He's also acted as associate director and choreographer with Martine Van Hamel's New Amsterdam Ballet. Kevin McKenzie was then appointed artistic director of American Ballet Theater in October 1992, where he's been these last 30 years and is making this a swan song of sorts, pardon the pun. As I said, he's received many awards. I will not name them all. He is very, very available, accessible, abundant searches, but I just want to conclude the introduction with he's a founding board member of the Katzbahn International Dance Center in Tivoli, New York. And as it's a tradition to name the education for all of my stellar guests, he received his ballet training at the Washington School of Ballet. He comes today from Orange County, where he's overlooking the performance of the Nutcracker at the Performing Arts Center. Welcome to Ask a Leader, Kevin McKenzie.
Wonderful. It's so good to be here.
First, congratulations on a phenomenal achievement of steering an internationally influential and revered ballet institution, American Ballet Theater. And it's the long view of your career that I'm really, really interested in exploring with you today. I guess I'd like to start with, over this time, the arc of the dancers' careers over your time with ABT. Has there been a change in how dancers have been, how their talent has developed, how their bodies have maintained, how body types have changed as well?
You know, it's really interesting. When you talk about the overview in my career as a dancer and as a director, I've just always been so busy doing what I'm doing. I never really stopped to look backwards. I just kept moving forwards. So it wasn't until I stopped dancing that I took a look backwards over my career. And now that I'm wrapping up this second career, I'm for the first time taking a look backwards and reassessing. And it is remarkable how dancers have changed. They've changed mainly. Great dancers love to be in the presence of other great dancers. So they learn from one another at least as much, if not more, than their mentors or the people in the front of the room helping them, coaching them, guiding them, whatever. And there's something physical that has happened that I think might have been fed by the honing of technical training, not unlike Olympic performers. Every time you watch the Olympics every 4 years, the records just keep getting broken, steadily on a steady given pace. Think back to when we first saw Olga Korbut and how amazing that was. And now look at what's going on in women's gymnastics, and you go like, wow, that looks like an old black and white movie. I would joke and say, is it in the water? I mean, it's not just that the physicality is refined. There seems to be two things that stand out to me. Stamina. They have far more stamina than I think we had when we were in my generation, when we were dancing. And they have flexibility to the point where it's almost too much. It's like they're missing ligaments or something. They have power and stretch, which gives their physical instrument an enormous range of expressiveness. But I think the thing that is the most standout that evolves for me is their knowledge of their instrument. I mean, when we were dancing, we want to dance, and you had aches and your pains and you push through them and unless you had a bone sticking out of your leg, you could make it. It was based on your pain tolerance. Today, they have such advanced physical therapy, and they can kind of predict what's going on, like a biologist, they can name the muscle that is inflamed so they can, and they adjust how they work to preserve it. So the scientific part of the art that is connected to the athleticism has really changed, and it services them to be able to, be kind of superhuman from my point of view.
And they can survive their career well then with the kind of attentive therapeutic, occupational attention made to their bodies.
Right, because they have a much bigger support system, granted, than they did when I was dancing, but they also have, as important, they have a self-knowledge of how their system works, And, the days of the dancer, sitting in the hallway smoking a cigarette, that's a pretty rare sight these days. They tend to do what our mothers all told us, get plenty of rest and drink lots of water and eat regular meals. And they take care of themselves, because ultimately that's what it takes for a really talented dancer to have a long career. I always have defined the definition of talent as the ability to realize your gifts. You can be incredibly gifted, and that isn't up to the individual. That's just the gifts you were handed down at birth. But if you don't have the talent to realize them, you're going to go nowhere. And one of the things that I remember so vividly of a mentor of mine, when I finished my training, she said, I know you want to go to ballet theater. That's been your dream. And that's how you've been trained. You've been, we've honed you to be that kind of dancer, but you're all of 18 years old. You've just come home, you've won a medal, you're full of yourself, and basically you would dance if nobody paid you a penny to do it. So now you're going to get a job, and somebody's going to start paying you, and you're 18, your hormones are raging, and you're going to be on your own for the first time. Stay here in town, go to the National Ballet of Washington, and figure out how to live your life to support your habit, instead of develop habits that will stop you from accessing the life you want. And it was the best advice I ever got. So I carry that with me when I became a director, that, you can come across these amazing talents when they're really young, but you do have to be careful that they're really young and that they should be doing age-appropriate work. There is this panic instilled in dancers that the career is so short that you've got to get everything really quickly. You've got to be, hit the big time by the time you're 22 or it's all over. And it's like, no, I'm sorry. I can tell you from experience, I didn't do my first full length classical work of Petipa until I was 28 years old. I was capable of doing one at 22, but I wasn't really prepared. I wasn't emotionally, and I didn't know myself well enough to do it. Because the worst thing that can happen to a dancer, and more so in this age where we got the internet and everybody knows everything about everybody, is try to provide them with a support system or an environment that helps them understand that it's important for them to develop as an artist before they become a star. Because they're growing up today in a society where you need to become a star first and foremost, and then we'll fill in the details. And that's just a recipe for disaster.
Well, thank you so much for that. And such an important kind of way to lead all of these artistic professionals. So another kind of a long view question over your career at ABT is, when you assumed this leadership role 30 years ago, AIDS was the scourge of many performing artists and patrons of those arts. Could you contrast for us the effect of that scourge compared to the scourge of COVID on performers and audiences?
Well, it's a different kind of scourge, obviously. I mean, we lost, you know, I'll tell you a quick anecdote. I had some little honor that I got a few years ago, and they asked, could I invite, friends, associates, dancers from ABT to attend and whatnot. And, you know, my family lives very, very far away from where this award was happening. And so I thought the most convenient thing is the dancers. I had access to the dancers, so I invited some dancers to come. And they got to the award, they got all dressed up, you know, and they were like, well, where are your friends? Where, you know? And I kind of had to stop, you know, like the friends that you grew up with dancing. And that's when I kind of had to portray that notion that, well, you know, most of the people I dance with in my generation aren't here anymore. And, you know, that's, of course, because of the AIDS crisis. So the world was robbed from a lot of voices that could have really contributed and maybe slightly changed the story and the arc of this art form in a different way. But with COVID, it wasn't a silencing. It was surviving. It was, I'll never forget that few months between February and April of 20, when, you know, the unthinkable happened, that we had to like cancel our Metropole opera season. It's one quarter of our performing opportunities for the entire year. And then like a month later, cancel our fall season and all the tours and whatnot. And I thought, my God, we're performing art. You know, this whole generation could turn into a lost generation. But what happened? You know, the necessity is the mother of invention. And we all got down to, you know, we need to be creating work. We need, you know, dancers and creators only evolve by practicing their craft. And because, you know, the only thing that was good about for me, and don't get me started on social media and all that. I find it personally a destructive thing for society. But in this case, it was the thing that saved everybody, because we were able to huddle down and create works in bubbles, in absolute bubbles. We found locations around the country for dancers to literally be isolated from the outside entirely. They lived together, they worked in a studio and created new work. Food was delivered from the outside. They never saw another human being. And we did them in 5-week pods, yeah, where people created works and then we filmed them. So people discovered talents they didn't know they had. Certain dancers, you know, started to come in, you know, started to get interested in filmmaking. Others just reinforced how much, you know, and having the ability to perform live taken away from them, how important it was to them. And they, like everybody during COVID, it was an inflection point. They had to reevaluate why they were doing and what they were doing and what they expected of what they were doing for fulfillment in their life. And so although the AIDS crisis took many people away from us, the COVID crisis indeed did take people away from us, but in the artistic community, we became the healing. It was our job to start the healing. We were the respite for the world, so we had a job. Whereas with the AIDS crisis, the job was saying goodbye to people. It was processing grief. Not that the COVID crisis wasn't all about grief, but it bonded and banded the artistic community together to survive no matter what.
And for that, we audiences all over the world, thank you for that, because that was very much a nurturing in our isolation that you all reached us, and I can think of your company as well as other companies. If you just joined us, my guest is Kevin McKenzie, Artistic Director of American Ballet Theater, stepping down at the end of this year after 30 years. So many cultural institutions like the Metropolitan Opera have had to navigate complicated connections with Russia. How, Kevin McKenzie, have you managed that, thinking now of your choreographer, Alexei Radmansky, and his affiliations around Ukraine and Russia?
Well, it's been a remarkable journey for him. It's and for all of us, you know. I mean, ultimately, we have to draw the line that it's not Russian artists' fault that they have, that they are led by a state that is disrupting the world in the way that it is. We've seen around the world many Russian artists fleeing Russia. But Alexei stands in a very unique position because he is Ukrainian, but he has had much of his professional career in Russia. And I think it's not unknown that he was making not one, but two huge projects, one on the Mariinsky Theater and one on the Bolshoi at the time the war broke out. And he within, like a 24-hour period just said, that's it, I'm canceling these and I'm leaving the country and I'm not coming back until that man is gone. That's a pretty bold statement.
And he made it very public. I mean, canceling a run is a production is a very big thing, but he underlined it with bold fonts.
Yeah. And it has had, deep personal, his family's still in Kiev. It's torturous for him. So what is he doing? He's using his art form to make a statement for the Ukrainians that we just will not, you're not going to make us lose our identity. And he's put together to keep adding to his schedule. Well, he's still working with us and he's still creating works around countries around in Europe, but he will not work in Russia. But in addition to the other work that he does, he put together a group of Ukrainian refugees and started staging ballets and presenting them to the public. And it's a labor of love of his, but it's also a focus that I think he has. It's a renewed pride in his identity, of who he is and where he comes from. But not unlike COVID, an artist turns to their art. Art is a reflection of the times in which we live. And we as an institution at American Ballet Theater, what can we do beyond as basically the world does? It's who's going to endorse this action of Russia, really? But is it our business to get into it? No, our business is to heal with our art. And we will just continue to do that, as will Alexei.
Thank you for that. So as Susan Jaffe assumes the role of the new director of American Ballet Theater, I'd like for you, Kevin McKenzie, to describe for us how different the baton was that you picked up 30 years ago from the baton that you're handing off to her. And I'm thinking all over the map, the changes in the cultural reference points like the Nutcracker and in other ballets, how think representation in the kinds of performers that join ABT and all of the things that Susan Jaffe's going to assume as the new director, what that baton looks like from what you assumed.
Well, basically what I assumed was a place in pretty much shambles, like virtually no finances. And, it was a mess, but it was a very different company. At the time I joined, there was no education department. There was basically a couple people in a press department and maybe 10 people in a development department and a general manager and that's it. we're a much different company now. And we have, although I can't boast that we're, the most financially secure institution in America, we have our feet firmly on the ground and did in fact start programs to counter the narrative that, you know, ballet is elitist and, you know, white supremacist and all that, like a decade ago. So we are well on our way. We've got a long way to go, but we're well on our way culturally thinking. Years ago, when the many stories about why are there no black ballerinas and it's only white people in big ballet companies, I kept saying, you know, the thing is, the general pop, you can't just go find somebody and put them in place. You have to train them. It takes 10 years to make and train an artist that was capable enough, both technically and artistically, to get to the age of 18 to compete to get the audition for a company like ABT. So it's not a matter of us hiring the wrong people, quote unquote. It's a matter of finding a way to get access to people who are not in a position to get the training. It's about access. So we started a program, I don't know, 12 years ago, it's called Project Plié, to literally scout out talent, students of color that had talent, and give them access to really good training through our national training curriculum and a teacher training system that teaches ballet at a... There's two types of schools in my estimation. There's what we call the competition school, and then there's a sort of more of a conservatory approach. And I wanted to take more of a conservatory approach so that students of all races, creeds, colors, and economic backgrounds could get access to that wonderful journey that I had, which was you just discovered that this was something you, the joy of dancing, the joy of expressing and moving to music. And that's all you need. That's the hook on the line. You get them hooked with that, and then they want more. And then you start to train them in a more strict way, but you don't give them, you know, like the top role, you know, what bothers me so much is to see a young girl or a young guy doing like Black Swan pas de deux at 12 years old. You know, that's just not age appropriate material for them. So we designed a system of training, and indeed 10 years later, we are now seeing more applications from dancers of color that are trained well enough to come into our school that we can train them. And now we're starting to see the demographics of our company change. And it wasn't much of a shift, really, because ABT started that way. I mean, when we were founded, we were a very international company. I think really what it is what Susan is inheriting are the intricacies now of the battle that's going on in society. You know, in all honesty, there's a fringe on the left as well as a fringe on the right in the terms of how we should be culturally treating one another and what the expectations of that are. But be that as it may, it's real, it's here. And so we're all learning a new language about how to not be talking about how we're treating each other with disrespect, but respectfully embrace one another and focus on our art. And Susan is enormously well equipped for that, so that, you know, she's inheriting something that has the beginnings, and the machinery is kind of in place, if not perfectly oiled. But what she has, I don't mean to imply that, you know, she's got it easier than I do, because exponentially, I think it's going to be harder. It's a bigger company than I did. It's not as simple to just say, make it so, you know, because there's only three people that you have to get to put something in motion. It's a big organization, but she's of it. It formed her. It's as much of her identity as it was mine. We had so many shared artistic experiences, and most of those came from ballet theater. So the rest is really societal changes that we need to incorporate into the company, that we have started that journey already. And I think she's more versed in it than I am. So I think ultimately she's inherited a heavy lift, but she's more equipped to succeed in it, I think, than I am.
Wow. So the audience development, there's a lot of layers to audience development. And I'm thinking partly of, we had on our midterm election on California's statewide ballot, a proposition to support arts education K through 12. So I want to know if there's a role that art education throughout the country is a part of building your audience and building your art form, besides what you're talking about in developing, like the Jacqueline Kenyon Nassis and the other conservatory approach to training mm-hmm. your dancers early on.
You know, you touch on a thing that's very, don't get me started. I always use this phrase, shame on us as a country, that we bought into the notion in the 80s that arts and education was not really all that important for us as a society. We needed to put our money elsewhere. And here we are. There, you know, it was left up to the artistic institutions to educate the public, quote unquote, to develop their own audience. Well, you know, a ballet company or a symphony or an opera company is not in the business of educating the populace, but we had to get into it, and enormous amount of resources, of human resources, to do that. I applaud this law in California, and it should be. I mean, the value of one of the ills of our present day society is not only the lack of arts education in the public school system, it is the lack of education, period. The fact that we have a generation of young adults that can't identify where a state in the United States lies on the map, forget a country in Europe or in Asia, is shameful. It's just plain shameful. So, you know, until, you know, the artistic institutions can only do so much. They can't educate the entire country. We are not the government. So, yeah. And, you know, you get the government you deserve, and you get the results of that.
So it seems like a public education exposure to cultural arts are a mother's milk of sorts that sort of bring in that part of a civic, bring that contribution into one's individual development.
Absolutely. It's like you have to, you know, life is not about a set of numbers. Life is not about, you know, Instagram fame. Life is about exploring the human element and celebrating what the definition of excellence in human achievement can actually be. And the arts provide the emotional, I can't pull the word up, but if people don't have a sense of self to understand and identify what brings them peace and joy, then they're only going to have their work and the measure of what other people think of them to live with. And that's why we need to educate our children with the arts in mind. It is the only thing that can teach critical thinking. The rest is strategy. Strategy will only get you so far, you know, and it's gotten us to where we are in our society today. So look around.
Well, thank you for that. And so off to your next work at the Kotzebue Cultural Park in Tivoli. Congratulations on your life's work at ABT, and best wishes on all your future pursuits. Thank you so much for your time today, Kevin McKenzie.
Thank you.
Good luck.
All best. It was wonderful to be with you. Thank you.
My guest was Kevin McKenzie, Artistic Director of American Ballet Theater, stepping down at the end of this 30 years career there. American Ballet Theater's Nutcracker will continue to be performed at Segerstrom Hall now until December 18th. The details are available at scfta.org. Welcome back to the show. My guest in this segment is David Ivers, Artistic Director of the South Coast Repertory in Costa Mesa, with a little year-end reflection and a little next-year opportunities. He's been at the helm now for 4 years at South Coast Repertory. Prior to his appointment at South Coast, David was Artistic Director for Arizona Theater Company. Before that, he contributed both as an actor and director at Utah Shakespeare Festival, leading up to his last role there as artistic director. He was a resident artist at Denver Center Theater Company and has helmed productions at the Guthrie Theater, Oregon Shakespeare Festival, Berkeley Repertory Theater, and South Coast Repertory. He taught at the University of Michigan, University of Minnesota, Southern Utah University, and Southern Oregon University. We are recording this on December 23rd. Welcome back to Ask a Leader, David Ivers.
Thank you. I don't know who that guy is you just described, but I'm very grateful to you for spending some time with me. It's meaningful. Thank you.
Well, thank you, because I know that as this holiday gears all the way up on the 23rd, that everybody is hunkering down, trying to warm up and stay with those that they care most about. So going so far, things going pretty well, building back up your audience and your cast since the before times?
Yeah. I mean, I would say we're having the best run of it right now since the summer. Up until now has been, I wouldn't say entirely smooth sailing, but we're in really good shape. Artists have been incredibly vigorous and full of virtuosity. Audiences have been stunningly supportive. Our actual audience participation and audience connectivity, those numbers are actually way up, which is great. And I think the season so far reflects kind of the vigor of the programming and also an appetite for people to be back kind of interfacing, which is all exciting.
And I guess the landscape has changed a little bit too since the late fall. The Orange County Museum of Art is now, there's a different kind of traffic, and it may be a little too early to know what kind of a bump you're getting from the museum's opening there. But is there an indication you may already have?
I think the indication is that the museum's getting a bump because of South Coast Rep's terrific numbers. At least that's what I'm suggesting.
No, I think you're right, though. When I saw Nina, the play Nina, afterward, there was someone, an L.A. resident, actually, who came down. And actually, for your play, she stayed overnight so she could be around and hang out. But
yeah,
she wanted to check out the museum because she was at the Rep.
Yeah, no, I think I was being sort of tongue-in-cheek. I think, look, the whole point is we're a campus where we interface. We all represent different aspects and disciplines of the arts. And we should be helping each other for visibility and for participation. And I don't have any factual data that one is affecting the other. But I know for a fact it's a good thing all the way around that we're there together.
So the theme you're going to be striking this next stretch of the season with Voices of America, it includes a play, Little Foxes, the classic, and Appropriate, sharing cast members presented in alternate days there. It's never been done before. David Ivers, how did you hatch this and how does it work?
Well, it's actually, in form, it works like it has for like decades. It's simply true rotating repertory theater, meaning you'd go to one show in the afternoon and then our crews work very hard in between shows and reconfigure the set. And that evening you see many of the same actors you saw in the afternoon in a new play, in a different play. So that true rep, rotating rep, is still in existence at several theaters and used to be a mainstay of a lot of theaters. And I think it's one of the most compelling ways in which an audience can be awed by the magic and transformation of artists, actors particularly, but designers as well. And the reason we're doing it, I think, more aptly is because these two plays, written by astonishingly important American writers, one no longer with us, one very much with us, both have something to say about the fabric of the country. And they both should be in conversation with each other. South Coast Rep is known in part for its kind of pioneering spirit about new play development. But we're also known for breadth and scale. And I've been very interested consistently in how the classics speak to new work and new writers. And Lillian Hellman's written Little Foxes, which is a classic that's not been represented on SCR stage. And Brandon Jacobs Jenkins' Appropriate, or Appropriate, depending on how you look at it, is a relatively new play by a writer now under commission with us that our audiences need to know about. And so I kind of said, I think we really should do this. It's a theatrical event for the season. It'll expose our audiences to two playwrights they need to know. And also it will give them a package of something that I think is very compelling. I've had too much coffee.
No, not at all. So is it a verb or a noun, the second play that Brandon Jacobs Jenkins? How do we pronounce it? Or that's the whole idea?
Because that's the whole idea. You'll have to decide after you see it.
Right. And I usually interview you after I've had a chance to see the production, but obviously we're not going to see anything until starting late January 28th. So, and it'll be running, but we'll give all those details at the end. And plus it'll be in the podcast summary. So this is also the director, Delicia Turner Sonnenberg, for Appropriate, and Lisa Peterson directing the Little Foxes. And it's sort of like two kind of based in Southern California women also having their dialogue too.
Yeah, totally. Completely. As a matter of fact, they're both artists who I admire greatly. And it's been really, I approached each of them with a mandate, which is, we're doing these together. You're sharing a cast. You're essentially sharing a set, because they're both set in a house in a plantation home in the South, to, you know, decades apart. But those houses, as you know, still exist. So all of this seemed to be a really exciting opportunity. But it is a different model. And actually, both of them just spoke very eloquently on Tuesday about what it's meant for the two of them to be able to, as directors, kind of have a partner to discuss their individual plays, to discuss the plays as they overlap, to discuss the meaning of them and how they intersect with this initiative. And I'm grateful that both of them are at the helm. They both have tremendous experience and are dedicated and really, really astonishing artists. So
for those of you who've just joined us, my guest is David Ivers, artistic director of the South Coast Repertory at the Segerstrom Center for the Arts in Costa Mesa, about the shows on the roster this season. So, and you have opportunities for audiences to be engaged with talkbacks. And so talk about all of that way you're bringing everybody along.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that was also important to me when I got here was like how the conversation continues with these plays, pre-show, post-show. And so, you know, if you go on our website, you'll find all sorts of different ways to engage with these productions, from artist talkbacks to community talkbacks to we're even piloting dinner between the shows when you can see it on one after the other. So if you went on a Saturday and saw Appropriate in the afternoon, you could stay, have dinner, have a conversation that's moderated, and then go back in for Little Foxes, which I think is a really exciting way to have a full-on marathon at the theater. And so, you know, and the idea of the rep itself will be discussed, which I know is a new idea, oddly, to South Coast Repertory, since it's in our title, but it's a really thrilling way to experience theater. Well, I was just saying that there's all sorts of engagement with the productions aimed at giving context both to the idea of the rep, to each play in particular, how they work together. That includes artist talkbacks, includes community talkbacks. We're piloting on a couple of days dinner between the shows. So if you come to see both in one day, you can see the matinee, stay for dinner. That includes a moderated conversation, and then go to see the second one. I mean, the thing about repertory theater and these activities is, like, honestly, live theater and true rotating repertory theater like this, we were way ahead of Netflix and Hulu and Apple TV, way ahead of it. So this will take some people back to their roots.
I'm thinking, because of the two settings being roughly about a century apart, correct?
Yes.
So that I'm going to say, from what I'm continuing to learn, especially recently, vividly in Twitter spaces that are just taking no prisoners. I'm learning so much, David. And I'm hoping the talkbacks I'm going to get to go to, I expect your Black patrons are going to be saying, see, nothing's changed, or see what little's changed, or see how it's changed, or see how there's a slate of hand of giving people the impression that there's change. I mean, I really hope that there's going to be an invitation from management, from, and the, will the directors be at some of these talkbacks?
Well, the directors are off contract the moment the show's open, and they'll go back home. But we have a vigorous panel, and we have a vigorous engagement speakers, myself included, that an artistic staff, of course. And I just I can't let this go by. I don't hope that it's just our Black patrons. That to me is not a great way to think about this. I think our patrons in general, right, the whole of our community, regardless of race or identity, have an opportunity to interface with two insanely important stories that intersect in part with race, but also about the building of business, about the minimalization of a female's voice. But also, there's a lot of theatrical fireworks, a lot of comedy,
yes,
a lot of slice of life. So I think to minimize it for one hope that a certain section of our community, you know, is able to point out what I think we all better know in this country, which is we're sitting inside of a very complicated bed of racism that continues to permeate through all communities. And look, that's part of the reason we're doing this, right? Is there are two gigantically important plays that on their own are just well-made, fantastic rides,
yes,
you know?
Yes. And well, yeah. I bring that up because I've been, as I said, participating in some of these or listening in some of these spaces, and there's so many foul cards that have been thrown up in the field where a white person has been... is not attuned to, you know, the Black experience. So that's my hyper focus. I own that, David. But and I understand though that all of the other dimensions that are in the classic and what we'll learn about Brandon Jacobs Dakin's appropriate. So it's just a hyper focus where I've done most of my learning in the last 6+ years versus sure. My understanding. Human nature for all its
good. Yeah, no, I think it's an important. I think it's an important thing you bring up. I'm not minimizing that at all, but I think the plays are they're aimed. Look, they actually center whiteness, and that's a very difficult thing to be thinking about right now. They center whiteness in order to be revelatory about something else about who we are. I think they're important plays. They do center whiteness, which. They center whiteness in order to reveal other things about who we are, right? But they also speak to truths about this country. And yes, Brandon Jacobs Jenkins is a Black writer, and I haven't produced a season here and won't produce seasons that don't wrap our arms around all of who we are in this country, because that's just an essentially important ingredient to who I am as a father who reflects back what the world really looks like, as an artist, and then as a civic leader. And a not-for-profit leader, those things are just embedded into the experience that I want our audiences to have, right? And so this became a very, very interesting way of having that conversation inside of two plays, not just one, you know?
And David, I can so appreciate the layout of South Coast Repertory's spaces that this is going to... It's the scale that's going to allow a kind of intimacy and an immediacy for patrons to be drawn into all of these features in these plays more effectively than, let's say, a much larger theater.
Yeah, I think there's something great about seeing these. They are gigantic, intimate stories. Seeing them in the Segerstrom is exciting. They're also, like, you know, gorgeous plays. I mean, Little Fox is just on a design level. Seeing a play in the early 1900s, just, you know, in this design, Edwardian, revisiting those designs, those colors and shapes and silhouettes is really stunning. And then seeing six of those people in that same evening on essentially in the same house in jeans, you know, is going to be, I think, a feast, you know. And I don't want to look, there's these plays are they're both, I believe, Appropriate's destined to be a classic. It's a modern classic already. I think it's a masterpiece. It's hugely theatrical. Little Foxes has been well worn. It's a solid and amazing piece that's, as I said, never been done at SCR. But both of them, I wanna underline, are like lessons for theater in not sort of, oh my gosh, I'm gonna go to the theater and be taught a lesson. There are lessons in theater in about the power of language, the absolute hilarity of, you know, watching someone be Machiavellian and watching someone be conniving. There's, I mean, Lisa Peterson describes Little Foxes as a thriller, you know, and I think there's some of that inappropriate. These are not stodgy plays that are going to make an audience feel like, oh, I've just gone to a lecture at all. And so there's an element of both of them together too that I think encompasses that as an appealing part of why to go, you know?
Well, this sort of begs a question, listening to you talk about this, David, the lessons for theater. How can patrons understand that you, as the artistic director, the directors that you have signed on to bring these plays to us, that the patrons are allowed to audibly respond anytime during the play?
Totally.
Because yeah. I'm sure you can tell which audience, you can tell the audience by the sounds coming out. I mean, I'm thinking of a play I saw recently. It was Clyde's up at the...
Oh, yeah.
The demographics were the kind where there was absolutely zero audible, sort of callback response. There's no audible reaction. And I felt kind of suffocated in a way with it. The play begged reactions, but anyway, so here's your PSA, David Iverson, to mention the listeners, you all have a lot of permission and we're encouraging you to audibly respond to our performances.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know through the ages how it's happened that some audiences are quiet and others, you know, are more demonstrative. But I absolutely. I mean, you know, comedies don't work without laughter, right? And I'm all for a good gasp and a good, you know, amen in an audience. And we at South Coast Rep certainly have no. Nothing in writing or no mandates that people sit on their hands and cover their mouths. I will say, you know, that one of the side effects of COVID and masks has been a diminished response from an audience that is really noticeable when you're on stage. And that's kind of a double-edged sword because obviously we want to keep people safe, but also, you know, we're not getting the robustness of a response, you know. But I say, let it rip. Have a blast. That's what the theater is supposed to be. It's live, you know, not watching a TV.
Right. Well, that's good that we can talk about that. I appreciate that. Well, the productions, as I was mentioning earlier, Little Foxes will begin January. It's 29th through the 26th of February. And appropriate, I'm going to be saying them both, the verb and the noun. January 28th through February 26th. And you have a few more productions you want to give us a nod to for the remainder of the season, David Ivers, before we close.
Yeah. The biggest thing I think to note about the rest of the season is we still have some announcements to make about Outside SCR, so I won't give that away now, but that's very exciting. The biggest thing I can say is we're celebrating the 25th anniversary of the Pacific Playwrights Festival. And I think people are in for a pleasant surprise. Those titles of those readings, the five readings and two productions, were just about, I think, done with selecting those. And the reading titles will be announced in the next month or so. And then, you know, where we did in PPF a couple of years ago, although it was virtual, Charlie O's Coleman 72, which is about a Korean-American family on a camping road trip as the father sort of finds his way into the possibility of a new job back in Korea and what that means for his first generation American kids. And his business is democracy. And so the camping trip in a way ends up being this beautiful memory story of how democracy may or may not always be prevalent in a family, if that makes sense. So it's pretty funny and heartwarming and adventurous. And a really interesting glimpse of who we are. And And then, of course, I'm not going to go into too much detail about this, but we're looking at the world premiere of a new musical in opposite it, and then those five readings. So it's a really exciting season that's, I can't believe, sort of halfway through. And then we'll head back to the Mission for our third installment of Outside SCR, and that everyone can stay tuned for another few weeks. We'll have that announced, but it's a pretty exciting project.
Well, we can maybe talk about that when there won't be any lulls, but maybe there'll be a moment your communications department will hand you back, and we can boost that from.
I'm excited. Yeah, I'm always happy to talk with you, and I'm a fan. So thank you for always being so supportive.
Well, thank you, and thank you for your time today, David, and a happy, hearty holidays with your near and your dear.
Back to you, and love to all the listeners, and best wishes for a happy new year.
Well, thanks. My guest was David Ivers, Artistic Director of the South Coast Repertory at the Segerstrom Center for the Arts in Costa Mesa, about the shows on the roster the remainder of the season.
Well, I certainly had a lot to share with you for a closer appropriate for the year's end, but had to trim it with the loading up the other show, the other interview of Kevin McKenzie. So this is my wrap. Next week's guests are going to bring us up to speed with the California Public Utility Commission's recent unanimous vote on solar rooftop metering, which affects every one of us. Espe Vilma, Executive Director of Environmental Coalition for Justice for Water, and colleagues of hers will be talking about this whole situation. She'll break it down for us on January 3rd next year. And if you missed a portion of today's show, you know how to get back to me at askaleader.com for all the programs that you might have missed this last year. I really thank everybody for listening so much that I want to actually, I'm hitting my tin cup here. I'm asking you for support. You could donate at year's end to KUCI. Go to our KUCI.org website, and on the Your Donation tab, you can hit the hyperlink UCI's e-giving site. And we so much would appreciate your contribution. To the close of 2022, we shall see you in the new year. Talk with you next week then. Thank you, everyone, for listening.